Imagine underwriting a massive commercial deal right now. You have the structural engineering reports, you've got the floor plate analysis. I mean, the load-bearing walls are totally pristine.
Right, the bones are perfect.
Exactly. The bones are perfect. But instead of finalizing the financial model based on those blueprints,
Well,
your primary metric for whether this multi-million dollar asset actually pencils out is, well, it's the sidewalk outside.
yeah, which completely inverts the traditional risk model we're used to. I mean, we are so accustomed to isolating an asset, right?
Oh, totally.
As analysts, we look at a commercial property and we want to quantify its value strictly within its own four walls.
Right.
If the building is structurally sound and the capital stack is organized, the assumption has always been, the deal is viable.
But the 2026 commercial real estate market, particularly when we look at these office to residential conversions, it's really proving that those traditional underwriting metrics are just insufficient now. The math inside the building no longer works if the ecosystem outside the building is dead.
It really doesn't.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. If you are an institutional investor, maybe a commercial property owner or a fund manager looking to navigate a portfolio through this highly volatile landscape, this briefing is heavily designed for you. Today, we're breaking down the latest Pre's Perspective newsletter.
Yeah, which is an incredible read.
It really is. It's authored by Priyanshu Adathakar, who is a top-tier commercial real estate and hotel investment advisor. And the central thesis here is essentially a massive wake-up call regarding where real estate alpha actually lives today.
Yeah, the underlying argument Pri makes is that the rules of asset valuation have migrated. We're looking at a market where the physical structure, the asset itself, is basically becoming secondary to its immediate environment.
Right. The key to a project generating those targeted returns isn't found in the architectural feasibility anymore.
Exactly. And to really grasp this, we should start with the macro view presented in the briefing, because you really have to understand the current inventory to understand the problem developers are facing. The baseline reality is that the low-hanging fruit of office to residential conversions, it's gone.
It's completely gone. And we should probably define what made that early fruit so easy to pick, right? Over the last, I don't know, 5 to 7 years, developers really targeted those older, historic vintage buildings.
Yep, the ones from the 1920s or 30s.
Right. Those structures typically featured narrow floor plates. They had these U-shaped or H-shaped footprints, lots of operable windows. Converting them was, well, relatively straightforward because you could naturally get light and air into every single residential unit.
Which is pretty much all you need to satisfy basic building codes.
Exactly. But the market has largely absorbed all of that inventory. The prime downtown assets with those perfect footprints, they're spoken for. So the inventory sitting on the desks of fund managers today looks, well, very different.
Oh, wildly different.
We are talking about the 1980s and 1990s glass box office building.
Yeah, the behemoths.
Right. These massive structures with deep floor plates, often 40 or 50,000 square feet per floor. And they're sitting right in the middle of isolated, single-use suburban office parks.
Which presents just a severe structural challenge. I mean,
Right.
think about it. If you try to carve up a 50,000 square foot floor plate into apartments, the units in the center of the building have absolutely no access to natural light.
Right. It's just a dark cave in the middle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, you can engineer your way out of that, sure. You can core out the center of the building, drop in a massive light, well, reconfigure all the HVAC systems.
But the capital expenditure required to do that is just immense.
It's astronomical. And this is where the analysis in Pri's perspective really pivots the conversation.
Yeah.
Because, even if you spend the capital to core out that building and completely solve the light issue, you still haven't solved the primary vulnerability.
Yeah.
You engineered a structurally perfect residential building, but it is sitting in a sterile office park surrounded by a sea of asphalt parking.
It actually reminds me of holding a flagship smartphone that doesn't have an operating system installed, you know?
Well, that's a great way to look at it.
Like the hardware is flawless,
Yeah.
the engineering is state of the art. But without the software to connect it to a user's daily life, the device is essentially just an expensive brick.
Yeah, and that is the exact operational reality of these isolated assets. The surrounding environment acts as the operating system for the building.
Right.
The data Priyanshu highlights suggests that developers are acquiring these modern, structurally sound office buildings in isolated parks, thinking they've secured this massive discount.
Because the price per square foot looks great on paper.
Exactly. But an architectural marvel in a sterile ecosystem isn't a bargain. Pri makes it clear it is a liability on the balance sheet. Real Estate Alpha has migrated entirely from the interior engineering out to the exterior neighborhood context.
So let's drill into the mechanics of that shift. Because if the blueprints don't guarantee the returns anymore, you and I as investors need to understand how we are actively underwriting the exterior.
Right.
The briefing frames this as a transition away from adaptive reuse and moving heavily toward neighborhood curation.
Yeah, and those are two very different disciplines. I mean, adaptive reuse is fundamentally an architectural exercise.
Yeah.
It asks, you know, can we change the physical use of this structure?
Right.
But neighborhood curation is an urban planning exercise. It asks, can we build a 15-minute city infrastructure around this structure?
Yeah.
And according to the Price framework, that 15-minute rule is the new baseline.
The new standard.
Yeah. The viability of a residential conversion is strictly tied to how quickly a tenant can walk to essential daily services. We're talking groceries, healthcare, social hubs.
Okay, but I want to challenge that just a bit from an underwriting perspective, because as a developer, I can control the architecture, right?
Yeah.
If a floor plan is bad, I allocate capital, I hire the best engineers, and I fix it inside my spreadsheet. But I cannot easily build an entire neighborhood inside an Excel model.
No, you definitely can't.
So how are institutional investors actually supposed to underwrite the risk of a location that fundamentally lacks those walkable essentials?
Well, according to Pri, by recognizing that you can no longer separate the asset from its context, you literally cannot underwrite the two separately anymore. The thesis here is that if the surrounding neighborhood doesn't function as a 15-minute node, the residential units simply will not lease up.
Not at the velocity you need anyway.
Exactly. They won't lease at the velocity required to service the debt. The whole financial model collapses because, well, you aren't just selling a place to sleep anymore. You are selling access.
Access. And the data presented in Pri's briefing puts a very specific hard price tag on that access. This isn't just, you know, theoretical urban planning feel-good stuff. This is driving hard returns.
Oh, yeah. The numbers are staggering.
Right. Residential units in former office buildings are achieving a 20 to 25% rent premium when they are located within 500 meters of a high-quality, daily-use anchor tenant.
And in the current macroeconomic climate, I mean, we need to be very clear about what a 20 to 25% premium actually does to a capital stack.
Let's unpack that. Because with construction costs remaining super elevated and interest rates compressing debt yields across the board, a 25% bump on the rent roll is not just an added bonus for the general partner.
No, it's not margin padding at all.
Right. It is the single variable that dictates whether a project gets approved by an investment committee or dies on the vine. Without that premium, the massive upfront capital expenditures required to core out these deep floor plate buildings simply do not pencil out. The debt service coverage ratios completely fall apart.
Yeah, which totally explains the massive capital rotation we are seeing right now. Institutional capital is actively fleeing those isolated suburban office clusters. They are moving aggressively toward mixed-use urban nodes.
They are chasing that 500-meter radius.
Exactly. Because that radius represents a fundamental psychological shift in the renter pool. As Premise points out, the renter in 2026 is paying for what he terms lifestyle efficiency.
Lifestyle efficiency. I like that.
It's crucial. Time has become the ultimate luxury. If a resident can walk 500 meters to acquire their groceries or access basic health care, they are recapturing hours of their week. And that regained time is literally what generates the 25% premium on the rent.
But, okay, here is the major friction point for a developer who is already holding one of these stranded assets. Let's say you own a massive office building in a dead suburban park. You can't just wait a decade for a vibrant neighborhood to organically grow around you.
No, your debt is maturing long before that.
Exactly. You have investors demanding returns now, so you have to manufacture that ecosystem yourself.
Right. Your pre-development phase has to completely bypass the floor plans initially. Priyanshu emphasizes that the immediate priority is creating what he calls cultural gravity.
Cultural gravity.
Yes. You have to manufacture a reason for people to want to exist in an otherwise sterile environment.
And the newsletter identifies two very specific types of anchor tenants that are necessary to create that gravity in today's market: boutique grocers and AI health clinics.
Yep.
Now, a boutique grocer makes total sense to me as the ultimate daily touch point. People need food. But the AI health clinic is a really interesting evolution.
It is. It's bringing preventative, tech-enabled wellness directly to the ground floor of the residential space.
Right. It merges food and healthcare, which are the two absolute primary pillars of the 15-minute city infrastructure. If you can secure those two tenants on the ground floor of an isolated building, you instantly transform a stranded asset into a self-sustaining node. You have successfully manufactured that lifestyle efficiency.
But, and I know where you're going to go with this.
Yeah, let's look at the financial reality of doing that. Because this is where a lot of traditional fund managers listening to this are going to throw up a massive red flag.
Oh, absolutely. The cost.
The sheer cost of securing these specific anchor tenants is astronomical. I mean, if you want to sign a boutique grocer, you are looking at heavy, highly customized buildouts. We are talking about reinforcing the concrete slab for commercial refrigeration.
Right.
Upgrading the building's electrical switchgear. Routing massive grease traps and exhaust shafts up 20 stories to the roof. You are blowing millions in upfront tenant improvement allowances, the TIs, before they even sign the lease.
Yeah, the TI packages are huge.
And on top of that, you often have to slash their initial base rent just to convince them to take a chance on an unproven neighborhood. So how does a sponsor defend intentionally taking a massive loss on the ground floor to their investment committee?
Well, that right there is the defining tension in the market right now. And it is exactly why the analytical framework provided by Priyanshu Ratnathakar is so critical. In Preen's view, you have to completely discard the traditional margin-focused logic when you're underwriting that ground floor.
Okay, so how do you categorize it?
You do not categorize the million spent on the grocer's build-out as an amenity cost. You must categorize it as a critical risk mitigation strategy.
Risk mitigation for the upper floors.
Precisely. Let's run the logic Priyanshu lays out. Without the boutique grocer or the health clinic generating that daily foot traffic, the 300 residential units above them lack lifestyle efficiency.
Right.
If they lack lifestyle efficiency, they do not capture the 25% rent premium. Furthermore, the lease-up velocity stalls.
It grinds to a halt.
Yeah. Instead of leasing the building in 12 months, it takes 36 months. And as you know, the carrying costs on a $100 million construction loan for an extra 2 years. That will destroy the project's internal rate of return far faster than the $5 million you spent on the grocer's tenant improvements.
Wow. Okay, so the anchor tenant is not just a standard retail lease anymore. It is quite literally the engine driving the viability of the entire asset. You willingly sacrifice the margin on floor one to guarantee the premium on floors 2 through 20.
It is the only way the math works in a post-low-hanging fruit environment. You have to subsidize the gravity.
Which brings us to an absolutely fascinating structural shift in how municipalities are responding to this. Because securing these anchors is no longer just a private sector problem. City governments are starting to realize that the survival of their own tax base depends on these conversions working.
Yeah, and this is leading to what Priya calls the emergence of vertical neighborhoods. In these massive multi-million square foot office conversions, the first two floors are ceasing to function as traditional commercial retail space.
Yeah.
They're increasingly being treated as public infrastructure.
Let's just pause on the gravity of that for a second. We are talking about city governments looking at a private, high-end boutique grocery store or a private health clinic and deciding it qualifies as public infrastructure.
Yeah.
Typically, when we see municipal tax abatements, you know, pilot programs, or tax increment financing, they are strictly tied to affordable housing units. The city gives the developer a tax break in exchange for dedicating 20% of the building to lower-income residents.
Right, that's the standard playbook.
But the briefing points out that cities are now offering specific tax abatements for the essential retail itself.
Because the municipalities have run the exact same math the developers have. A city cannot simply mandate that developers build housing in dead office districts to solve a housing crisis. If the district remains a food desert, the housing fails.
People move out.
Exactly. The residents leave, the building defaults, and the city loses the property tax revenue anyway. Therefore, the city is forced to incentivize the grocery store just as heavily as the apartment units. The retail is what enables the housing.
This fundamentally alters how a senior analyst should be building their pro forma. That ground floor retail space isn't just a loss leader you have to swallow to satisfy the residents. It acts as a mechanism to unlock municipal subsidies for your entire capital stack.
And this is where true market alpha is generated today. Identifying these shifts in municipal tax abatement policy early and understanding how to mathematically underwrite a retail lease as a catalyst for public subsidies, it's incredibly complex.
Oh, absolutely.
It requires synthesizing urban policy, retail logistics, and high-level financial engineering. This ability to see the structural shift before the wider market prices it in is exactly why Priyanshu Adithakar is a primary authority for navigating these specific investments.
So we have covered the exhaustion of the historic inventory. We've gone over the mechanics of the 500-meter premium, the staggering costs of manufacturing cultural gravity, and this wild shift toward public infrastructure subsidies. How do we distill all of this into a concrete, actionable underwriting principle for the listener?
Well, the ultimate takeaway is that the siloed roles of the commercial real estate industry are basically dead. In 2026, a successful developer must operate as part architect, part financial engineer, and part urban planner.
Right.
If the neighborhood ecosystem fails, the building's structural integrity is irrelevant. The directive here is to stop looking exclusively at the facade and the floor plates and start aggressively underwriting the sidewalk.
And the briefing offers a highly effective litmus test for any new deal crossing a fund manager's desk right now. Pri refers to it as the car test.
Yeah, I love the car test.
It's so simple but so telling. When you are evaluating an office to residential conversion, you have to remember that you are no longer selling square footage. You are selling lifestyle efficiency. The square footage is just the container. So you look at the asset and ask one simple question. If I take away the car, does this building still function?
It strips away all the architectural noise and gets straight to the underlying risk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if a resident cannot acquire fresh food, cannot access basic health care, and cannot engage in a social hub without getting behind the wheel of a car, the asset fails the test.
And if the asset fails the test, the briefing emphasizes that your immediate priority is not demolition. You don't call in the interior framing crews. You don't start coring out the light wells. Your first job is curation.
Yeah.
You have to curate the surrounding ecosystem and secure the anchor before you even touch the blueprint.
Because the institutional capital has already made its decision. The market is not going to wait for legacy underwriters to catch up.
No, they're moving fast.
The funds are already flowing toward the mixed-use urban nodes that offer that lifestyle efficiency, and they're actively divesting from the stranded assets that don't.
So, to briefly recap our deep dive today, navigating the complexities of the 2026 commercial real estate market requires completely abandoning the legacy adaptive reuse playbook. Real Estate Alpha is now inextricably linked to 500-meter walkability.
Exactly.
Success hinges on a developer's ability to secure daily use anchors, like those boutique grocers and AI health clinics, to manufacture cultural gravity. And doing so allows investors to capture that vital 20 to 25% rent premium while potentially leveraging totally new municipal tax abatements that treat essential retail as public infrastructure.
And honestly, those who continue to underwrite based solely on a building's internal blueprints while ignoring the exterior context, well, they're going to find themselves holding massively devalued stranded assets.
So here is the challenge we leave you with today. Look at your current portfolio or pull up the pipeline of deals sitting in your queue right now. Rigorously apply Pri's car test to every single one of those assets. If you took away the car, would those buildings still function?
And if the answer is no, you need to fundamentally rethink your strategy and reevaluate your risk exposure immediately.
The rules of the asset class have changed permanently.
They really have.
Which leaves us with a final, somewhat provocative thought to mull over, building directly on this idea of retail as infrastructure. If an essential anchor, like a health clinic or a boutique grocer, is now recognized as the critical risk mitigation engine that literally guarantees the success of a $100 million residential tower,
yeah.
How long until the math pushes developers even further? Will we soon see major institutional developers offering commercial ground floor space to these specific anchors for absolutely zero base rent just to ensure the upper 30 floors lease at a premium?
Wow, free rent for anchors.
Right. In the era of the vertical neighborhood, does the traditional profit-driven commercial lease eventually become entirely obsolete? Because remember, you can own the most technologically advanced, structurally perfect smartphone in the world, but without the operating system to connect it to the real world, it's just an expensive brick.